Welcome to Inside the Guard, the show that takes an in-depth look at the biggest fights from this weekend. I am your host, TP Grant. Good morning, afternoon, evening, or whenever it is you choose to listen to this. Thank you for taking the time. So the UFC hosts an event on Valentine's Day, much to the dismay of its spoken-for fans. And I've actually seen this card take something of a beating, both from fans and media, and I'm a little bit perplexed by this because I really enjoyed the card. There were some excellent fights and some really, really good prospect action on this card. Of course, the night was topped off with the stunning upset of Benson Henderson submitting Brandon Thatch in the fourth round with a rear naked choke. Now, I was one of the many people who thought that Thatch, in all likelihood, would knock out Henderson at some point or just physically overwhelm him in the clinch. But Henderson put on a rather masterful performance as he surrendered rounds in an effort to outlast the much, much larger man. Thatch has only been out of the first round twice in his 13-fight career, and those fights represent his only two losses. And it's not to say that this was easy for Henderson. There were moments of pure survival in the first two rounds for Henderson. And he started getting beat up a little bit, trapped against the cage a few times. He ate a couple really nasty knees. But when that third round hit, it was very clear that Henderson's strategy shifted and he started pressing Thatch and working for takedowns. And once on the ground, Henderson took the back in the third round and used a body triangle to both control Thatch and, I assume, make it difficult for Thatch to rest and really catch his breath. For those who haven't experienced it, the body triangle is awful. It's like a vice grip on the trunk of your body. It makes it really difficult to breathe. It makes it painful to breathe. And it puts tremendous pressure on your back, specifically your lower back, which is a real trouble spot for me. And so I spend a lot of effort when I'm training staying out of the body triangle. And if I get caught in it, especially if it goes belly down, I really quickly tap because it just does horrible things to my back. So for Thatch to be caught in that for extended periods of time, I mean, you're spending energy just breathing and just trying to survive. So for him, it's not like that position is in any way a rest position or a place where he can recover from kind of a tough round. And then in the fourth round, Henderson got back to the back, broke down Thatch's defenses. Thatch tried to sit up real suddenly, and Henderson snatched up the choke. It was a really wonderful matador performance from the former WEC and UFC champion. And this fight was kind of a fun throwback to the days when weight classes were a bit looser and fighters were not locked into kind of their little boxes of being a welterweight fighter or a lightweight fighter. And I'm not just talking about, the freak show fights or the 90s no-hold-bars matches. Wanderlei Silva defeated Rampage Jackson twice, rather brutally in Pride. And he also fought Krokop and went the distance in 2012. Sakuraba consistently fought larger opponents to his detriment at times. And Frankie Edgar was the UFC lightweight champion, to talk a little bit more recently, despite being very, very small for the weight class. So Henderson mulling over going to welterweight isn't crazy. Some people are making it sound like it would be the biggest mistake of his career, but he just showed he can compete with a large, aggressive, and very physical fighter at welterweight. It's possible for smaller fighters to have a success up a weight class. Often it means they have a speed advantage and they don't have to cut large amounts of weight, which comes with its own advantages, the biggest being that you have more energy in the fight. But I mean, just in general, your training camp will be much easier. You'll feel better going into the fight because I've never really, really had to cut weight. I've watched people cut weight, and I can say that just as an outside observer of weight cuts, it is a really miserable experience, and it definitely impacts how well you can train. So for Henderson, I mean, there are positives for fighting up a weight class, but finding consistency up a weight class can be difficult. Henderson fought a near perfectly executed fight, and he'll have to keep that level of fighting if he wants to succeed against the upper crust of that division. And even then, he'll be at a severe strength disadvantage in some fights. I mean, I cannot see him having a ton of success in the clinch or with takedowns against the likes of Tyrone Woodley. And he's not going to be able to just rely on his opponent to simply run out of gas in the later rounds of fights against the likes of a Rory McDonald or something like that. So Henderson is in, he's caught between weight classes at this moment. He's in a bit of a Rich Franklin position. There isn't really a push to see Pettis Henderson 3 right now. And there isn't really much of a point for the UFC to have Henderson kind of hanging around at lightweight picking off contenders. So for Henderson, it makes sense to move up a weight class. You get paid, you draw some interest, you fight some fights that no one really considered. I mean, Brandon Thatch versus Ben Henderson was something that no one had thought of, and it just posed all sorts of interesting questions and didn't turn out the way kind of our snap reactions kind of judged it to be. So it was a really fun fight, and there are plenty more where that came from for Ben Henderson. I mean, he used to be a highly entertaining fighter back in the WEC days, and I think the pressures of being champion and kind of what the demands of being champion and the kind of performances you have to put on obviously impacted his fighting style. So going up a weight class has its benefits. It might not be the best choice in terms of his long-term physical well-being, but I mean, I thought he was going to lose to Thatch, so who knows? Maybe he pulls a BJ Penn and just adds a welterweight title to his trophy case. Now, looking down the rest of the card, there's actually quite a bit to talk about. Max Holloway got a big win over Cole Miller, and he's continuing to grow. Holloway, that is continuing to grow and blossom into a really good featherweight. Now, Cole Miller doesn't always fight to his advantage. I'm an absolute fan of Cole Miller. I just love watching him fight for a whole variety of reasons, and he's a really outstanding ground fighter, but I mean, Cole doesn't really fight to his own advantage. He rarely, if ever, seeks to take opponents down. And he's a competent boxer. I mean, he's quite a good boxer, but Holloway was just better than him on the feet. The headbutt was unfortunate, but clashes of heads happen. And if it was impacting Miller as much as he was saying it was, then that's on the referee to make the decision to stop the fight. And I don't think the referee necessarily handled it well. And you could tell Miller was getting frustrated, and Holloway did actually a pretty good job of taking advantage of the whole situation, which, frankly, as in like the terms of being a competitor, I mean, that's exactly what you need to do. Now it really makes sense for Holloway to take a step up in terms of competition, and that seems to be exactly what the UFC has in mind. John Anik bringing up the fact that the UFC would like to see Holloway in a fight with Cub Swanson, which makes pretty good sense for Holloway, as he's primarily a striker, and Cub Swanson is going to stand there and trade leather with him. And Holloway, I mean, he's come a really long way in his 3 years in the UFC, from getting absolutely punked on the ground by Dustin Poirier, and then, I mean, just kind of having a rough go of it when he got Dennis Bermudez and Conor McGregor back-to-back. He's really grown as a fighter, and is a really outstanding example of a fighter kind of developing within the UFC. And speaking of that, we had Neil Magny fighting directly before him, and he had a very, very solid showing against Keiichi Kunimoto. Magny is another one of those guys who has grown quickly under the bright lights of the UFC. His coach, Elliot Marshall, formerly of the UFC and The Ultimate Fighter, has really helped Magny put the elements of his game together. He wore Kunimoto down on the feet, and then once it hit the ground, he had very little to fear from Kunimoto's game off of his back. Despite the Japanese fighter actually being a very good grappler, Magny was just, at that point, Magny was too fresh and just too good from the top position, taking Kunimoto's back at the end of the second round, and then, or was it the first round, taking the back of it at the end of a round, and then repeating the task immediately in the next round and getting the finish. So solid win for Magny, and he's another guy who's in need of a step up in competition. Moving on down the card, Kevin Lee got a less than thrilling win over imposing Brazilian Prezarius, but it was an important win for his young career. Being derailed by big aggressive grinders is very common for up-and-comers, and Lee actually handled Prezarius quite well, if not in the most thrilling fashion. And to kind of punctuate that, I'm just going to move on, because there's not much else for me to say about this fight other than Kevin Lee's a pretty good athlete. He did a good job neutralizing the Brazilian's game, and he got the win, and that's what really matters. And I want to move on to someone who's way more exciting, and that's Ray Borg.
We are the Borg. Resistance is futile.
Okay, so for those of you who aren't aware, Ray Borg is probably one of the best flyweight prospects in the UFC right now. He's just 21 years old. He only started fighting in 2012, and in his fight against Chris Kaleidis, he looked outstanding. Now, Borg's a really good athlete. He's a young fighter, and he keeps an absolutely frenetic pace in his matches. And while he can get himself into trouble at times, he just kind of tries to explode into everything he does. And he can overdo it at times, and Dustin Ortiz was able to kind of out-grapple him at times and put him on his back, and Kaleidis had some success with that. I mean, he's just such a great athlete and so fast and so good at creating scrambles that he's able to make up for it, and he's really excellent at catching the back. He mentioned it in the post-fight interview that he feels much more natural going for the rear naked choke because he really likes spinning to that back, putting the hooks in, and then looking for the choke. And obviously in this fight, he got the Kimura from top position. It was a really nice piece of grappling. What I really like about Borg are his takedowns, because he does go down to his knees and gets double legs from his knees. But what he'll do is once he gets his hips under his opponent, he plants both of his feet. And then he doesn't just drive forward and turn the corner. He drives forward and up to get guys up off the mat. And then once he picks his opponents up, he puts them back down with authority and malice, and he's a lot of fun to watch fight, really exciting fighter, and going to be probably a top 10 featherweight, or I should say flyweight, a top 10 flyweight in no time at all. A little further down the card was an outstanding clash of prospects as Chaz Skelly took on Jim Allers in what was a really excellent fight, and Chaz Skelly surprised the heck out of me in this one. He's out of team takedown, and coming into the fight, it seemed pretty clear that Allers, and even during the fight, Allers had the crisper striking, but Skelly is just so accurate with his strikes, and he's out of team takedown, which is the same camp that produced Johnny Hendricks, and Johnny Hendricks was criticized for a while because he had kind of ugly striking technique, and the point that Hendricks always made in response to that is, well, it's ugly, but it's accurate. I'm very good at putting my hands on my target. And that kind of summarized Skelly in this fight. It wasn't pretty looking, but he was constantly hitting Allers accurately to the head with his right hand, and Allers' head was very stationary in this match. And in the end, he was able to get the finish. Now, Skelly landed a pretty clearly illegal knee right as the referee stepped in. And this is a tough gray area because it really seemed like Allers was kind of already done, but it was also a clearly illegal knee. Skelly was very apologetic after the fight, made it clear that it was not an intentional strike. It's not going to be, I don't think there's any chance of this fight being overturned or ruled a no contest because of it. And the referee apparently went to the commissioner and said he planned on stopping the fight before the knee landed. So it didn't really impact the outcome, but still just an unfortunate way to end a really excellent fight. Now, there was a really fun little sequence in this when Allers went for a topside ankle lock, and I couldn't help but geek out about this because it was an ankle lock very similar to the one taught by a guy I've trained under briefly at a couple seminars and have been in contact with, Riley Bodycomb, who's a big fan of what's known as a tripodding ankle lock. Now, to give you a sense for the movement, I've got a little video here of Bodycomb from a trailer of an instructional of his demonstrating it kind of on loop a couple times. And the basic concept is that it's an ankle lock from top position, usually in response to a guy throwing up his legs from guard. And if you want to learn more about it after I talk about it, you can go to Riley Bodycomb's website, rdojo.com, just the letter R-D-O-J-O.com. The Top Rock seminar is there, and it's a pay what you want, DRM free download. And then he also has his No Kirka series that covers this, and those are about, I think, $10 for each volume. There's two volumes, so you could legitimately spend around $30 and walk away with a couple hours of really good instructional tape. I mean, I'm not paid to push this. This isn't like paid advertising or anything. I'm just a huge fan of his stuff. I've trained with it quite a bit, and it's helped my leg lock game. And I'm a big, big fan of this move in Nogi. And Allers went for it, and it kind of was like a weird scramble position. Allers found himself in top position after rocking Skelly, and he went for what looked to be the tripodding ankle lock. Now, the key for the tripod ankle lock is that you take the foot and then you go off with an angle on it. You're kind of going perpendicular to their body. You're not going directly over the guy. And you, obviously, by the name of tripod, your knees and your one hand is on the ground. Your other hand is committed to holding their ankle. Now, here you can see Allers going for it, and he is in that tripod position. And you can see it right here. I've put the image up in my video for those of you listening to the audio only. It's Allers has the foot of Skelly wrapped with his right hand. He's got one knee on the mat, and he's in the process of putting the other knee on the mat, and his left hand is out based wide, creating kind of the tripod effect. Now, Skelly's leg is very bent in it. His knee's at like a right angle, like he's sitting in a chair almost. And that's not ideal for the ankle lock. So what Allers does is he looks to extend out. Allers has now committed his left hand to helping with the ankle lock, and he's replaced the hand on the mat with his forehead on the mat, which is giving him some pretty good stability here. Now, this doesn't end up being enough to get the tap, and so Allers starts posturing up, and it allows Skelly to turn to his knees. And you can see here now that Allers is trying to drive his hips downward while arching his back up in a position that gets referred to when people do this in footlocking as dolphining. And it's not usually a good thing. It's not a very efficient way to finish an ankle lock because Allers is trying to stretch the foot. Like, he's trying to make the, if you point your toes and your ankle goes straight, he's trying to get it to that point and then take it past that point. And it's a legitimate way to finish an ankle lock. It's just not always the most efficient way to finish an ankle lock. And now, I can't speak for Riley, but in times working with both him and guys trained who have trained with him more extensively on foot locks, in this position, Allers has a couple of options. Number one is that he wants to be straightening the entirety of Skelly's leg as he extends out. You can see that Allers' feet are crossed underneath Skelly. And really what he wants to do is have one of those feet being able to kind of stomp push on Skelly to kind of extend Skelly out and put more pressure on that ankle. Also, you really want to turn the ankle more sideways and in kind of like a twisting motion as if you're trying to give the guy a high ankle sprain. If any of you have ever experienced that where the foot goes straight but it also turns to the side. And also, the fact that Skelly's free leg has a knee on the ground is problematic, and usually kicking that leg out, kind of doing the stomp push off of that knee, is a pretty good way to get the finish. And Skelly actually said that in this position, his ankle popped. So Allers actually did, you know, what he's doing isn't incorrect. I want to make that very clear. I mean, he clearly knows how to finish an ankle lock. Skelly said that his ankle got hurt in this position, and Bodycomb actually spoke to this idea a bit when he was on Luke Thomas's technique talk on MMA fighting, which I'll put a link to in the article, where he said, if you're going to be a joint locker in MMA, you have to be prepared to not just, you know, break the joint or put pressure on the joint, but just absolutely mangle the joint, because that's what gets taps in MMA. Think Ronda Rousey, Miesha Tate armbar in their Strikeforce match, or Frank Mir with Nogueira, or Frank Mir with Tim Sylvia, or Husamar Pajares. Like, the really good joint lockers in MMA, they need to establish the fact that they are willing to just wreck your limb. And that's what gets taps out of MMA fighters. Because there's different levels of, like, what guys tap to. There's, like, gym taps where you're like, okay, I tap. I got caught, you know. Okay, yeah, it wasn't hurting yet, but I knew I was done and I wasn't going to spend a ton of energy fighting it. And then there's more, like, competition taps where you really go for a little bit. You might let things pop a little bit before you give up. And then there's, like, high-level competition taps. Like, think Metamoris or, like, the World Championships of Jiu-Jitsu or a high-level MMA fight where guys will willingly let things break in an effort to keep fighting. I mean, Tim Sylvia wanted to continue on after Frank Mir snapped his forearm in half. And it took Herb Dean stepping in and stopping the fight and saying, no, you're done, for the fight to actually end. So he needed Allers just needed a little extra power in this situation, and like I said, he did things right in this situation. I wouldn't necessarily want to say he did things wrong. It's just he could have done things to give himself a more efficient ankle lock and a better chance of finishing it here. So you probably noticed that I haven't mentioned Zaf Mikofsky and Tim Elliott yet, and that's because I'm saving that for our next little segment in which we go in-depth on a fight, because that fight was just too much fun. So we're going to go in-depth a little bit on this fight, and I'm going to be focusing primarily on things Zaf Mikofsky did in this fight, and that's not really a slight to Tim Elliott. He had a lot of excellent technique in this fight, a lot of really good grappling, but what he was doing doesn't necessarily show up in the format I'm able to use, since I'm not able to use like live action footage. The things that Elliott were doing don't really show up that well. And also Mikofsky was the winner and was doing more interesting things from my point of view, technically speaking. So I'm going to be focusing more on him, though we're going to get a little bit of Elliott in there. And really, both fighters were just excellent in this fight. And I want to start looking at the takedowns. And I mentioned this idea a little bit with Ray Borg, that the idea, like getting lifting takedowns. And I, for a long time, thought lifting takedowns were more of a function of strength. And I talked a little bit about this in the aftermath of Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier. But it bears going back over because it's fun. People getting picked up and slammed is just entertaining. And like I said, I used to think this was a function of strength, but really what pickup takedowns are about good body positioning. Now, we're going to start right here with an image, and those of you listening to the audio only, it's a pretty classic level change by Zaf Mikofsky. Tim Elliott has his, I apologize for the potato quality of the pictures. This is pretty much the best I have to work with when I can find images of the fight I can use at all. But Elliott has his right hand out, so he either was throwing some sort of strike or was trying to check the distance, and Mikofsky has gone under that hand in a classic MMA level change that you would learn in pretty much any MMA school or jiu-jitsu school or anything that deals with takedowns versus grappling, or takedowns versus striking, I should say. Notice that Mikofsky's right foot is planted. If you drew a straight line between Elliott's feet, Mikofsky's right foot is planted on pretty much that line between his feet. And that's what's known as a penetrating step in wrestling. The deeper you can get that step, the easier it is going to be to get your hips in and under a guy. And this is where like the athleticism really comes into effect. It's not on the lift, which is surprising. It does take some strength to lift people, but if you get in good body position, it doesn't take that much strength. It's really about getting your hips into position, and you got to have good speed on this penetrating step. So Mikofsky gets a great step in under this strike that Elliott threw, and he's going to get into really nice position. And that position is what's pictured now. Mikofsky has the right leg of Elliott wrapped up in his arms. His feet are firmly planted on the ground. He still has his right foot in kind of that in-between Elliott's feet position on that line. And he's taken his left foot and he's planted it really firmly on the mat. This is what I was talking about with Ray Borg. Ray Borg does this very nicely, pretty much anytime he gets a takedown. And what's really important in this position is Mikofsky's hips. They are under Elliott's hips. He's like in a squat, and his hips are at like knee level on Elliott, and Elliott's hips are actually up around Mikofsky's chest. And this is prime lifting position, and honestly, Elliott's kind of just helping things by kind of wrapping the head of Mikofsky. Notice how he's kind of leaning over Mikofsky. His chest is kind of on Mikofsky's shoulder. He is in prime position to leave the mat, and that's exactly what Mikofsky does. Next image, you see that Elliott is way off the mat at this point. Mikofsky is driving off of his feet, and you see his hips have come forward, and he's arching his back. The back arch in this case is not so much to get Elliott kind of going backwards as it is to push the hips in. The real key to lifting someone, and again, I kind of mentioned this in the Ray Borg thing, is not only to drive up, but it's also to drive forward. And the mistake actually most people make in the double leg is they drive forward and down in an attempt to get the person down. And that can work, but you're not going to get someone off the mat in that case. In this case, Mikofsky's driving forward and up, and you can actually see his other hand has come around. And this ends up being more of a lifting double leg sort of situation than a lifting single leg. But it's all about driving those hips up and forward. And now he's successfully picked up Elliott, and once you pick someone up, you really get to decide kind of how they hit the mat, and McCoskey puts him down pretty authoritatively. And later on, Elliott got to return the favor. And it was a slightly different situation, but, I mean, the concepts basically remained the same. It was just more of a on-the-back situation, if I recall correctly. So the next thing we're going to look at is something that I geeked out over pretty hard over Twitter, and even looking back on it, it still is a really fun aspect of this fight, and that's Zach Mikofsky's ground game. Now, Mikofsky came out wearing the logo of the Marcelo Garcia Jiu-Jitsu Academy, which, for those of you who don't know, Marcelo Garcia is like one of the luminaries of the jiu-jitsu world. He is incredibly accomplished, is considered to be one of the best sport grappling competitors ever. And he's a very small guy, and he plays a very distinctive game. And he had a huge impact on how people grapple in sport jiu-jitsu today. He kind of shifted the metagame. And one of his tenets of his game is that his game needs to work with the gi and without the gi. And he kind of developed his whole competition approach around being able to do both and as efficiently as possible. And we're going to see later on that he used Marcelo Garcia's favorite guard, the butterfly guard, because Garcia kind of feels that the guard is best used for sweeping. It's very difficult to submit from the guard, and so he prefers to go for sweeps and then finish from the back position or from top position. And Garcia almost never does arm locks, save for a few. He almost always finishes with chokes. And he never, ever finishes with head and arm chokes, like the arm triangle that we looked at last time, favored by the Nova Uniel guys. Marcelo Garcia almost, he doesn't use them at all. He is exclusively a neck-only choke sort of guy. Now, I mean, that sounds kind of weird that I mean, there's two basic ways to choke a person, and that would be either you wrap them with the head and arm and get the triangle effect, or you get just the neck wrapped up like the rear naked choke. The rear naked choke is the perfect example of this type of choking, and basically Marcelo Garcia likes that choke, and he will invert it and he'll reverse it. The reverse of the rear naked choke, if you just think about it and you flip the position around, is basically the guillotine. You're still wrapping the neck up in the same way, but instead of being behind the guy, you're in front of the guy. And the inverse reverse of that, if you turn the guys upside down and put them around and turn them around, is what's known as the north-south choke. And Zach Mikofsky attempted the north-south choke. And it's a very, very efficient choke. It's really underused in MMA. I think I've only seen it. I mean, obviously, Jeff Munson absolutely loves this choke. It's in some circles known as the Munson choke. But for those of you that haven't seen Jeff Munson do this to pretty much everyone he ever fights, we're going to take a look at it right here. And who better to demonstrate it than Marcelo Garcia himself? This video was taken off of YouTube. I will post the YouTube video in the article, and it's from MarceloGarciaInAction.com, which is Marcelo Garcia's website, and it's generally considered to be one of the best, if not the best, subscription-based jiu-jitsu website. So if you're into Marcelo Garcia's game, if you want to learn more about it, go to that website, sign up for it. I know many people who have it, and I don't know any of them who have said it's not been worth it or they haven't learned anything. So let's take a look at it. Now, the basics of the north-south choke is that you start out in side control and you swing to the north-south position. But as you can see right here, Marcelo Garcia, after clearing the hands of the guy, wraps the head. He wraps over the head and kind of comes around. And he's going on details about how to kind of make sure that you're cinching the neck and catching the neck. But you kind of trap the head between your body and this inside of your arm, and you kind of put their chin in your armpit, and you're laying face down, your chest down, and they're kind of looking up at the ceiling with their chin kind of stuck in your armpit. And this is the basic finish position. And one of the keys to getting the finish here, just getting this position and squeezing, it can be enough in the gym. Guys might tap to the pressure on their neck, or sometimes like you'll get like kind of a neck cranky squeeze out of it. But the real key to this, and Marcelo is going to demonstrate it for you, is the idea that you want to bring your shoulder kind of across their neck, and you kind of pinch your shoulder down to your hand. And that's what really puts the pressure on. And that's really how you get the finish with the north-south choke. It's an incredibly efficient choke if you can actually get under their chin and get your shoulder to their neck. and get the grip up, it's incredibly easy to get the finish. And Marcelo Garcia has stated that he feels it's as high percentage as the rear naked choke for him in no-gi competition. And so we can take a look at Zach Makovsky attempting this choke because he did a pretty good job of catching this. So here is Zach Makovsky in the first round, and he has gotten into north-south choke position. It was off of a bit of a scramble. He was on Elliot's back. Elliot kind of sat up. He didn't have hooks, so he reached over and kind of pinned him down. And Makovsky has kind of all the important things in place at this point. He's sprawled out nice and heavy, so there's no way Tim Elliott can turn him over. He's looped around Elliott's head, and he also appeared to be under the chin of Elliott. If you take a look at it from a different angle, it does appear that he is under the chin of Tim Elliott. But as you can see from this shot, Elliott is clearly under pressure. You can see his face. He's grimacing. There is pressure being put down on him. But Makovsky at this point has not dropped his shoulder across. You can see in this picture that Elliott's shoulder is kind of still very up, like he's kind of hunching and or shrugging. And what he was going, what he needs to do to finish the choke is to bring the shoulder kind of down and to the left across Elliott's throat to get the choke. And it's not like Makovsky didn't know this. He knew exactly what he was doing in this position. So why didn't he actually end up getting the choke? Well, that's because Tim Elliott successfully defended it. He did an excellent job defending it. Going back to the Marcelo Garcia video for a moment, he points out that when you're in this position, you don't want your head up because it gives the guy a chance to bring his hands in and to push on your neck, and that Marcelo wants to hide his head down. It helps him get his shoulder down. It helps him drive into the choke, but also it keeps them your opponent from pushing your head up and taking pressure off of their neck. And as we flip back to the fight, you can clearly see that Elliott was doing exactly that. He was bringing his hands in and trying to create space and keeping Zach Makovsky from being able to dive his head down and thus dive his shoulder down to finish the choke. Elliott actually did a wonderful job getting his hands into position and really, really fighting this choke. And he was able to eventually get Elliott's head kind of up and create enough space to kind of get his palm in the action and really push on the head. And right here, you can see, so it's still Makovsky kind of wrapping up the head of Elliott, but Elliott now has his left forearm kind of under the chin of Makovsky, kind of creating a frame, and then now is pushing Makovsky's head away with his right hand. And this is quite literally seconds before Makovsky is forced to let go of the choke to kind of address this pressure on his head, pushing him away, and Elliott is able to escape. So while it was a really, really good choke attempt by Zach Makovsky, it was really excellent defense by Tim Elliott. And, like I said, Elliott did a lot of great things in this fight, just not a lot of it that shows up really well in this kind of like picture description format that I have. One more thing that we're going to look at is both fighters were using the butterfly guard quite extensively. Now, Zach Makovsky actually hit a sweep with it. So we're going to talk about kind of the use of the butterfly guard and how you can use it to both sweep and how to retain it. We're going to look at Makovsky, but understand that Elliott was doing quite a bit of this as well and doing it quite well. So we're going to take a look at another MG in Action video that was put up on YouTube to kind of help promote the website. And it's going to be of his butterfly guard, Marcelo Garcia's butterfly guard, which he's known for. It is kind of his iconic guard along with the X guard and a few other things that he does. And the butterfly guard, the reason Marcelo Garcia likes it is because it's ideal for sweeping opponents. And MMA fighters like it because it's both ideal for sweeping opponents and it's really good at creating space and allowing you to move and get back up. Now, there are three elements to any sweep, basically. And one of them is that you need to off-balance the person that you're going against. If they're perfectly on balance, they're going to be very difficult to sweep. So the first thing you need to do is disrupt their balance. Sometimes opponents do this for you. The second thing you need to do is take away their ability to catch themselves. So in this example, Marcelo Garcia is going to show how important it is to trap the arm of your opponent in the direction that you want to take him. Because if you don't trap that arm, it's very possible for him to use that to catch himself and stop your sweep. And once you've effectively trapped that arm and kind of taken that ability to catch themselves away from them, you just need to add a little bit of momentum. And now let's look at the butterfly sweep being done correctly. So here's Marcelo Garcia in kind of a sitting butterfly position, which doesn't really exist in MMA because of the strikes. And guys don't really fight from their knees like this, but the concept is there. And it still works in MMA. This position is just kind of a sport grappling specific position, but the concept of the sweep remains the same. So you have Marcelo Garcia. He's going to disrupt his opponent's balance by using his grips on the back of the head and on the arm and kind of turn the steering wheel. And he also has a grip on the guy's arm so that there's no real way that he's going to be able to get out. And you see Marcelo is kind of popping him over. So that's the off-balancing. And then once he off-balances him, Marcelo's going to sit to his side, and he's going to use that butterfly hook to kick up and lift his opponent's hips up and bring him over. And that's really where the momentum comes from. He's not going flat to his back. He's flipping out to his side. So that's the basic butterfly sweep. And when you hit it, it should feel pretty effortless. It feels like the guy's just kind of rolling off you. So let's take a look at how it was used in the fight. So we're starting out in the second round, and Bukowski's been taken down, and his guard has actually been passed by Elliott. Now, it's not a complete guard pass in like the sport jiu-jitsu term, but for the sake of argument, Elliott has passed his legs and is getting into a dominant position. And now, Elliott actually found himself in this position quite a bit and did what we're about to discuss quite well, because getting the butterfly guard or retaining the butterfly guard is very difficult and takes quite a bit of practice. And where Makovsky is right now, obviously he has no guard. His guard is pretty much done, and he is simply fighting to not be put on his back. So to get his legs back in play, Makovsky needs to create space. So you see his feet are planted on the cage, and Makovsky's going to do a simple hip escape. He's going to hip out by pushing off of the cage. There's the hip out. You can see all that wonderful space that Makovsky's created for himself. Now, he could use this to go to his knees right now and try to wrestle him, but it appears that Elliott's got a pretty strong overhook, and I can't see what his other arm is doing, but he may be either cross-facing Makovsky and making it very difficult for him to get to his knees, or attempting to work for a guillotine, and Makovsky doesn't feel quite like, you know, going into a choke. So he's actually going to cover that distance back in between their hips. Makovsky's going to reclose that distance, but he's going to do so bringing his leg up on the mat. And now his legs are back in play, and he's now regained his guard. Then the cameras in the fight switch angles, and we get a pretty good view that it looks like Elliott is attempting to crossface Makovsky and put him flat on his back. So you can see now that Makovsky is taking his right hand and he's controlling that arm that's cross-facing him. Now, that means he's actually trapped Elliott's arm into position, which is exactly what Marcelo was talking about in the idea that you don't want them to be able to post their hands. And now, on the other side of Elliott's body, if you look, there's Makovsky's left hand, which has an underhook, and you can see it just barely. The left foot has come under Elliott's thigh to get that butterfly hook. So on the left side of his body, Makovsky has two limbs that are able to apply really good force on Elliott. And Elliott is driving so far forward that he's a little off balance in this situation. So all Makovsky has to do is actually push off of his the foot that's on the mat. You can see that his right foot is kind of driving off of the mat, and he's bringing Elliott forward and pulling him off balance, and then he's going to add momentum with the underhook and the butterfly hook to get a picture-perfect butterfly sweep. And these were just a few instances of awesome grappling in a fight that was just absolutely full of it. And Elliott was doing a lot of this too. That kind of shifting his hips out to re-guard and recompose the butterfly guard, Elliott was doing that near constantly when Makovsky was on top of him. And Makovsky was doing an excellent job kind of stuffing the butterfly guard and kind of playing a little, playing his weight the right way and posting his hands out to make sure that he couldn't be swept. And there were just so many awesome exchanges in this, and kind of a really high level MMA grappling exchanges. And the fact that the two of these guys are so willing to integrate kind of the butterfly guard, and for Makovsky to go for a very underutilized choke in MMA, the north-south choke, it's highly applicable, very efficient, and more guys, honestly, should be attempting to kind of integrate that into their games. It's just a really great display of MMA grappling, and kind of one of those fights where that's really what we hope, where we hope the sport is going in terms of like ground fighting, in terms of like how guys interact, where the bottom guy is making constant efforts to chain together, standing up, sweeping, and submitting. Because that's what both of these guys were doing. And the top fighter is using excellent takedown technique in the case of lifts and good body position, and really taking the submissions that are available, and kind of this whole thing, even like bringing in, like going back to Aller's ankle lock attempt and things like that, kind of taking the submissions that present themselves and having like a deep enough technical base to threaten the fight, like threatening a fight ending technique pretty much from any position, in addition to being able to strike. Because right now it seems like a lot of MMA fighters are either strikers from the top or submission grapplers, and seeing a guy like Makovsky being able to kind of like mix it together, and Elliott like being able to mix together and play really good defense from the bottom. And, you know, he threatened a couple straight arm locks. He was able to stand up. He threatened sweeps. Kind of seeing that kind of all play together, that's exactly where we hope the sport is going in terms of, or I should say where I hope the sport is going in terms of ground fighting, where you just get this like great mix of high-level grappling, high-level wrestling, and kind of striking mixed in for what is a really entertaining and highly skilled product. And that's pretty much going to do it for us for Inside the Guard this week. Next week, there will be no Inside the Guard. Sorry, guys. The Sunday UFC shows, I really don't have the time to produce a show on Mondays. My day job doesn't really allow for it, so on any UFC events taking place on Sundays, unless I have some sort of government-mandated holiday the following day, I just can't make a show. I also am not going to be on MMA Prospectus this Friday, which it goes up on Bloody Elbow, usually on Saturdays, and we record on Google Hangouts with myself, Zane Simon, and Patrick Wyman of SureDog. But you should absolutely listen to it this week, because even though there's no UFC on Saturday, there's a ton of really good regional MMA action. And if you are into MMA prospects at all, there's tons of guys to be paying attention to. Top on the list is Tom Dukinwah, who we had him as number one, our number one featherweight prospect on the ranking list that I work on, the prospect ranking list with Zane Simon. But, I mean, that's not us being special in any way. Everyone has this kid as the number one featherweight prospect in the world, and one of like the top three prospects in all of MMA. He is headlining the Bama card that is taking place this weekend, and also on that card is another top featherweight prospect, Mike Grundy, who really entertaining, really fun wrestler, submission type guy to watch. Very young in his career, but very tough wrestler. KSW is also having a card, and it has two pretty darn good young featherweights on it, and I'm going to absolutely butcher their names, so feel free to make fun of my pronunciation on these. Anzor Ishiev, who is was our number 10 featherweight prospect, is taking on Keebler Kleoki Erbst, and I looked at this guy, really fun submission guy. He didn't end up making our list because, frankly, he's just a little too content to pull him guard and try to play for submissions from guard. But you basically have a guy who is an aggressive top position striker in Aziev, and Erbst is really content to play guard. So either Aziev is going to get way overzealous and get submitted, or Erbst is going to pull guard and get absolutely pounded out, and it's going to be a really interesting piece of matchmaking. Should be a lot of fun. So lots of good MMA this weekend. The UFC card is chock full of good young fighters. I know the main event sucks, but underneath that there's actually a pretty solid card, so should be a lot of fun. This show, Inside the Guard, will be back after Ronda Rousey and Kat Zingano. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about following that, and that's about it. Have a fantastic week. I'll see you on the other side of Kat Zingano versus Ronda Rousey.